Some people just belong where they are born. Others travel in search of a place to which they believe they belong. One such person, our guest today, traveled across the globe from his country, France, all the way to India, discovering India, falling in love with India, discovering its spirituality, and becoming one of us, calling himself an Indian now. François Gauthier, welcome to the show. You arrived in India when you were just a teenager, and you didn't take a flight. You came by road. You traveled right across. You must have seen many attractive places on the way, but your final destination happened to be India and Auroville in India. How did it all happen? Please tell us.
My best friend's father was the governor of Pondicherry. As you know, Pondicherry used to be a French colony. And so my friend told me there's a caravan of cars driving from Paris to Auroville to start a new city. And I thought, well, you know, I didn't know about India. I didn't know about Auroville. I was a very ignorant young man, full of cliches. And I thought, let me go around the world and I'll start by going to India. I was very young. So we drove from Paris, you know, across so many countries, Paris, Germany, Austria, Yugoslavia, Greece, Turkey. Istanbul was a wonderful experience, the Gate of the East, then Iran, Afghanistan, very beautiful country, Afghanistan. You climb the Khyber Pass, go down into Pakistan, and from Lahore to Delhi, it's actually very close. It's you know, we travel in the night because it was cooler for the engines, and we reached Delhi one morning, early morning. That was my first taste of India. We stayed in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, what is known now the Mother School. It's a huge compound now. Then it was a very small house, beautiful house in the fields. It was still in the fields in those days. And I felt I had come home. It's, you know, to say it today in words sounds subjective, but I closed my eyes and I felt, oh, this is home. I've reached home. And from Delhi, we drove to Pondicherry and settled in Auroville. Auroville, there was nothing. It was a bare plateau. No, it's on a height, Auroville. So all the monsoon had taken out the good soil. So there was nothing left, only red earth, few palm trees, few birds, completely barren place, but a great beauty. And there was a lady, a French lady living in Pondicherry called the Mother. She was Sri Aurobindo's companion. Sri Aurobindo was a great, you know, avatar and yogi and revolutionary. He was first a revolutionary. He fought for India's independence. And even in the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita, thought that the British had to be kicked out, maybe with force, out of India. And then I decided to stay. I decided that I would stay in Auroville and build my life.
And that's what, about 7 years or more than that, you?
That, yeah, I stayed 7 years in the ashram. Yeah. And she passed away, the mother. And of course, it was a great shock. I didn't know what to do with my life. I had made my life in India. So I started freelancing as a journalist because I had done some journalism and photography before leaving France. So I started freelancing as a photographer and a journalist.
So this was just simply a personal experience, or was it a higher level spiritual discovery, something that has remained with you for the rest of your life? How do you see various influences combining in your personality?
So India is a place of spirituality, you know, from Sufism to Hinduism to Buddhism. You know, all the persecuted minorities, religious minorities of the world found refuge in India because there's a great intellectual and religious freedom in India. Whatever it is said today, whatever problem there may have been today and yesterday. So from these villagers, you know, in Kerala to the Dalai Lama to, you know, people that I met, wonderful people. I interviewed Rajiv Gandhi 2-3 times, you know, when he was prime minister. He was a very nice man, very, you know, very, very beautiful man. So I met so many beautiful people in India. And I have soaked so many different spiritualities. As you see, my latest book is on Darashuko, who all his life remained a Muslim, you know. Even before dying, he recited the, you know, the prayer, you know, of faith of any Muslim. But at the same time, he accepted, you know, that there are other religions, other truths. So for me, the greatness of India is its spirituality, its tolerance, and the gentleness and the goodness of people. You know, I never cease to admire and to feel proud and to defend the goodness of Indian people and the good karma of India, because India has a good karma. It never invaded any other country, contrary to, you know, my country, France, you know, which invaded North Africa and other countries in Africa and Vietnam and Indochina.
If you were to distill your experience and your understanding of life, which includes spiritualism, and you had to give a message to a young man in this country today, a young man who's sort of perplexed about what he sees of materialism, what he sees of modernism, what he sees of politics, etc. What is the message that you would give him?
Be proud to be born an Indian. When I came as a young French white man, and I spent 7 years in the ashram of Pondicherry with 99% Indians, you know, from Orissa, Bengal, from all over India. And I saw these youngsters, and they were so supple in their body, so supple in their mind. I said, why wasn't I born an Indian? Why was I born a Frenchman, you know, in a faraway country? It was a good country. I'm proud to be a Frenchman too. But at that time, I told the mother, you know, give me an Indian name. I would like to have an Indian name.
And did you get one?
No, she said, it's better to change your nature than change your name. I still have that letter that she sent me.
No, of course, your message in life
has... Be proud to be an Indian.
...has been to get this message across to the world. When the world media writes about India, it looks for things of disaster, it thinks the ugly side of life, etc., etc. But some great things happen. We seldom hear stories across the world. So what is the message that you have to the world?
I fought all my journalistic life against this in France. You know, in France, there are Indologists paid by the French government to inform the French people about India, which is a very faraway country, very different from France, you know. So these Indologists keep speaking about caste and poverty, you know, and, you know, fundamentalism. So I've been fighting all my life because I wrote for, you know, big papers in France, for Le Figaro, which is the largest political daily in France. And I kept fighting, but I must say with not much success, you know. The cliches, the prejudices about India, not only in France, but in America. America is even more ignorant about India than France, unfortunately, whether it's Mr. Trump or Mr. Clinton, there's not much difference. Why can't the world recognize that India is a great country, very ancient, very wise, gave a lot to the world? But it's only when, as you say, only when there are catastrophes and problems in India that the media, Western media, speaks about India. But whenever great things happen, it doesn't come across. You know, they don't speak about it. So it saddens me, it angers me. I'm still fighting against it with my books.
Yeah, of course.
I'm still fighting against it to tell the world, stop looking at China. You know, true, China is doing well, but it's not a democracy. India is a democracy. The world is not giving justice to the greatness that is India. I know there are problems in India. I know there are problems. When I came back from France last time, you have to fill up, as a foreigner, you have to fill up an arrival card. Now it's an e-arrival card, so you can fill it up online. Now I went online and I saw it was 90 euros. So I was very surprised because it used to be free. Okay, I paid the 90 euros. So when I came to Delhi and asked the immigration officer that, you know, I paid 90 euros for that. He said, but it's free. It's completely free. There are people, you know, agents who are, you know,
trying to squeeze something out of you.
That make you pay 90 euros for something which is totally free. So I know that India has faults, you know, but at the same time, it's a great country, and it's sad that the West doesn't recognize this, you know. And I see, you know, Mr. Trump is one day blows hot, one day blows cold, you know, and one day says something good, one next day says something completely stupid, you know.
But you think the Indian diaspora, which obviously is linked with home, with India, etc., but has moved out and seen so much of the world. It's not doing enough of messaging for India, you think?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not doing it.
And why is that? Is there ignorance?
Selfishness. Or? My children first. I'll put my children in American universities so that they do well. You know, look at the Chinese again. You know, the Chinese Americans, you know, they felt proud to be Chinese. So they came back to China or they invested back into China. They gave, you know, they learned a lot in the US. So they gave this technology, this knowledge, this know-how back to China, making China a great country industrially, nearly on par with America. But, you know, Indians in America don't do the same.
Can we just turn for a moment to what is happening at home in India today? There is obviously a very clear sense that India has to move on. We have a rediscovery. We, by that many years, we want to be a modern, developed country, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody has to contribute to be able to get there. But in terms of a spiritual nation, in terms of a nation that is wedded in Gandhian ethos, etc., what is the score? How are we going?
So the religious diversity in India is astonishing. You know, there are
fantastic,
people
wonderful.
From every religion in this country. You know, and today the Tibetans are there also. And I am very fond of the Dalai Lama, the wonderful man. You know, who gave all his life to Tibet. I have interviewed him many times. So there's a great religious diversity in India. But it is true that at the moment, you know, But it's a world phenomenon, you know. There's a strife in the world that India cannot escape. At the moment, you see the war with Iran. You see, you know, what's happening in the West everywhere. There's a conflict everywhere, not only between religion, but between people, between Europe and America, you know, between Islam and, you know, Europe. So I believe that India can show the way to the world. But for that, and I think Mr. Modi made some effort. He did make some effort.
So it just touch upon foreign policy now, because your experience and knowledge of India and the rest of the world is remarkable. Just touching upon foreign policy and the sentiments that you have spoken of, we've assumed that India's foreign policy always had an ethical and moral element that came down from Mahatma Gandhi and the time of Jawaharlal Nehru, etc. Today, the world is becoming transactional and everybody is becoming very material. And therefore, the question arises when conflict happens, whether it was in Europe, Russia, Ukraine, West Asia, in Palestine, and with United States and Iran, etc. Is there a missing link of ethics and morality somewhere in foreign policy? Has it become too transactional and too money-minded? How do you see it?
Well, it's not an easy path for India because on the one hand, as you said, there's a war between Russia and Ukraine. And Russia has been a faithful ally, whatever faults Russia has,
absolutely.
And the Soviet Union before. You know, it's been a faithful ally of India. You know, I mean, I'm speaking about Indira Gandhi, the Bangladesh war, you know. America, Nixon sent, you know, his nuclear fleet,
seven,
you know,
fleet.
To intimidate Mrs. Gandhi. Yeah, but Russia, the Soviet Union, then stood by her, you know, and she did the right thing, you know, she did the right thing. There was a genocide happening in Bangladesh and she sent the Indian army, you know, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. So there is still that element in India, but at the moment it's difficult because Russia is a friend of India. It's still a good friend of India. I would say it's a more, you know, reliable friend than the U.S., you know, because it's been steady, whether the U.S. you know, can jump from one extreme to the other. And the same thing goes with the Iran war. India has a long relationship with Iran. And I believe Iranian people are, you know, refined people.
So the civilizational link that we have,
yes,
was critical. But it's so difficult in modern-day politics, international, global strategic politics, to be thinking of civilizational link. And then you have an issue between Europe and Russia. And we were being squeezed between two stones because expectations of United States and Europe were different from the expectations that we had about our friendship with Russia. And you know the crisis of being told that you can't buy discounted oil from Russia, etc. And the impact that has on the Indian economy, the Indian people, etc. Where do you think we should have been? What could we have done?
No, I think it's a tightrope exercise, and Mr. Modi is so far doing it okay. You know, at the same time, maintain a friendly relationship with Russia, which, you know, predates him from, you know, several generations. And at the same time, you know, there is a war going on, and from a Gandhian point of view, it's the right thing to say that this war should come to an end and there should be some kind of truce between Russia and Ukraine. The same thing is valid for Iran. You know, Iran is a friend of India. India depends on Iranian oil. You know, I think a lot of petrol comes from Iran through that famous Strait of Hormuz. So how to, you know, keep a balance between this war that America is leading on Iran and Iran being a friend of... I think so far Mr. Modi has done okay. It's not an easy role. So far he's done okay.
May I just touch upon something that would be of interest to all our viewers, particularly in Russian Federation? What is it... How do you see, for instance, attempts that are made in the country today by many people to take a fresh look at history? Some people want to rewrite history. Some people want to look at history afresh. Some people want to use history for political purposes, etc. And some people want history preserved in its true fashion. How do you look at this?
But you see, Mr. Putin showed the way, you know, that he gave back Russia its pride. He made Russians proud again. You know, and Russia came up in all fields, sports-wise, for instance. Yeah. You know, Russians are still remarkable sports people, you know, industrially, you know, you see Russians today in the world. They're proud of being Russian. So we need Indians to, again, say, as I've said earlier, you know, that I'm proud to be an Indian. You know, I'm an inheritor of a very ancient civilization, very tolerant civilization. All religions have flourished in my country. True, there are problems today. There are always problems, you know. All our life, you know, from birth to death, we face problems. You know, so we have to deal with problems. But I think that what Mr. Putin did to Russia is remarkable. He's hated in my country, France, you know, and I find it a little sad, you know, that they think that Russia is the greatest danger to the world. I personally don't think so, you know. I think there are greater, much greater danger than Russia.
Do you think there is scope for India playing a
yes.
bridging role
yes.
between Europe
yes.
and Russia?
Yes.
That's possible?
India needs to be a leader, you know, a world leader. You know? But for that, we need Indians in the U.S. who are, you know,
right.
projecting that, you know, that, you know, we are a great nation. You know, we need to be respected as a great nation on par with China, because China is respected. The Chinese don't, you know, they
don't... Is China honestly respected or held in awe because of its economic clout?
Both.
Because of,
yeah, both. You see, the Chinese will say, they will tell to Mr. Macron, okay, you don't do that, we won't buy your Airbuses, we're going to buy Boeings, you know. So the Chinese don't take any nonsense from anybody. I mean, so I think India should take some lesson from that.
Now, let us look at a platform like BRICS, which now has 11 countries. It was, the beginnings were in RIC, Russia, China, India, etc. But now it's expanded to South Africa and UAE and so on. What do you see, if at all, what do you see as the future of BRICS?
No, great future. It's only that within BRICS, for instance, you have, you know, India and China who are not always, you know, on the same wavelength, you know, but BRICS has a great future. We need to... The war with Ukraine has to stop as soon as possible so that, you know, Russia can concentrate all its energy on its own internal development, and BRICS is part of it. But I'm a believer in BRICS, I think, and there are many nations who have joined BRICS or want to join BRICS, as Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, so many nations.
They all want to come in.
Yeah.
But do you see any contradiction at all, or if a need for balancing between BRICS and Quad?
No, I think... BRICS wants to, you know, that nations depend less on the dollar, and I agree with that. You know, and the dollar has become so powerful now, so we need to have, you know, other countries like India need to be able to deal with their own currency rather than depend on the dollar, which is a big bully.
So they'll have to be back to the drawing boards as far as world currencies are concerned.
Yes.
There are things happening organically, but beyond that, I suppose people have to put their heads together to see. And the United States will not be happy about that.
No, definitely not. But I do think for quite a few years that in United Cities the power is on the decline. It doesn't show really in practice because they're still a super, super powerful nation. But I think the West in general is on decline, and the sun is going to rise in the East now with China and India. They're going to be the leaders of the world one day because the West is in decline. Europe is definitely in decline. I mean, my country, France, again, I'm proud to be France. When I go to France, you know, the French spirit is something unique. But it's a country in decline. And there is no doubt about it. England is a country in decline. I love the British. They're good people, nice people, friendly people. It's in decline. There's no doubt it's in decline.
Well, that's an interesting point at which I want to get on to the next question. Is you've in fact written a lot about the impact of colonization on India and repeated waves, as you've talked about, and that in the initial part we touched upon attempts in India, as in any other independent country there would be, to decolonize ourselves, to discover our true identity and decolonize ourselves. But as we do this, there are issues in our own neighborhood about the smaller countries around us who've been traditionally good friends of India and have been within the influence of India. Those countries now beginning to question India's intent and coming under the influence of China to sort of play one against the other. How do we deal with all this?
So I agree with the first part of what you said. You know, the Indian man needs to be decolonized. The British bled India. Oh, I mean, the famines that the British endured because they needed the raw materials for the two world wars, the First World War, Second World War. I think 20 million Indians died of famine under the British. I mean, this is a crime against humanity. We see it, you know, in the way that Indians export themselves, integrate very well in the UK, US, Canada, but at the same time lose part of their Indianness. So there has to be a decolonization of the Indian mind. There is no doubt about that. I'm fully behind it.
So there are two important dimensions, and I'm sure that you have some very good answers to these. One is language. We have multiplicities of language in our country, and of course, we respect every language. But there is a national language. Hindi is our national language. English has been a official language. English has been a language which has provided a link between the North and the South.
No doubt.
So what are your views on this?
Well, it's too late now. If you see Israel, you know, Hebrew had gone to sleep and they were speaking Yiddish because all the Jewish people are dispersed all over the world. So in 1948, when they got independence, the first prime minister, Ben-Gurion, got scholars and said, OK, just modernize that Hebrew, make it available. So this could have been done in 1947 or maybe later, that adopt one language, you know, modernize it, make it available to everybody and impose it. Hindi could have been that, but now it's late because there's a lot of resistance in the South towards Hindi. So I think Hindi is taking over in places like Andhra Pradesh. People do speak Hindi. In Tamil Nadu, no. There's a lot of resistance
towards Hindi.
But India needs a national language. I think Hindi should be probably the national language. I don't see any other language. Sanskrit, sure, we know that Sanskrit could have been the national language. It's too late now.
Now, for somebody who's seen such a remarkable expanse of events, reported on them, argued, as it were, and advocated India's cause across the world, including your country in France, etc. If you are somebody who's in teens now in France, moving out to go and discover India, what is the message or what was the advice that you would give to that person?
So India takes time to discover. It's a very complex, you know, vast country with different people. So one has to be patient in India. One has to be patient, you know, and not make judgments. I've seen French ministers who come for 2-3 days in Delhi and think they have understood everything. India is a very complex country, you know, very vast, you know, from Kanyakumari to Arunachal Pradesh or Kashmir. You know, it's such a different from state to state, different languages, different people, different, you know, food culture. So be patient. The problem of journalists in Delhi but I have been a journalist, full-time journalist for a long time, is that from Delhi, they go into a flight, you know, and in a five-star hotel. And so you don't see India like that, you know. I was lucky because I said, because I discovered India being a freelancer based in Auroville, traveling in Tamil Nadu. I did feature in Tamil Nadu, in Kerala, in Andhra Pradesh. So I discovered on the ground that Indians are very beautiful people. But if you live in Delhi and, you know, you fly all the time and you stay within that circle of embassy and journalists, this is not India.
But tell me just one last interesting question. Do you know of anybody who has traveled the other way from India to France and who has taken to France the way you've taken to India? Do you know any such person?
But France is a very simple country. Everybody is Christian. Everybody is white. I mean, less now. But when I was a kid, you know, simple country. You know, I mean, the French give lecture to India about, you know, religious tribe. But the Protestants and the Catholics were very bloody battles, you know, in the 18th century, 17th century. They killed each other happily, you know, in England also, you know, between the Protestant and the Catholic, you know, between Mary of Scots and Elizabeth, you know. They, you know, they killed each other themselves, you know, terribly. So I don't think Europe should give lectures to India. You know. I think they should learn from India. I learned from India. Whatever good I learned it here.
Well, thank you, François. You have been a wonderful experience, teaches me to think about you as being the true passage to India.
Thank you. I've read
that book many, many years ago. But to see in personification of a passage to India, a traveler to India, and a person who's found his destination, how wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for this experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.